The mission is ultimately to eliminate entire classes of vulnerabilities, and that happens through frameworks, guardrails, features that we build into the critical path of serving the user. And the other area of the team is called strategy and assurance. And that's where we really sort of like focus on the software development lifecycle and make sure we ship a secure product, we remediate vulnerabilities, we evaluate risks appropriately, we align with the business.
Welcome to the Future of Application Security, a podcast for ambitious leaders who want to build a modern and effective AppSec program. Doing application security right is really hard. Now I'm going to help you build a better future of AppSec at your company by curating the lessons from the leaders. I'm your host, Harshal Parikh, CEO of Tromso. And without further ado, let's get into it.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Future of Application Security. Today, I have Felix Mutinar with me. Felix, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Now, Felix, you are currently leading security engineering. You're head of product security at Asana. I would love for you to introduce yourself to the audience. Just talk a little bit about what you do.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm Felix, security technologist and engineering leader at Asana. I've been in the Bay Area for about 11 years now. I'm originally from Germany. I got my first job through the IRC, actually. I had a great security technologist, Caleb Sima, messaged me in the IRC somewhere in like 2011, 2012. I was working on mobile security and was asking me and a friend, hey, are you interested in a job in San Francisco, like working for a startup? And yeah, it didn't take us very long to decide that we're going to try this out. So I canceled my master thesis and took a flight to San Francisco. And yeah, 11 years later, still here.
That is such an incredible story. It is amazing to hear Caleb's name here, by the way. He was also the first podcast that I recorded in this series. So that's a nice flashback. He's awesome, by the way. He's a good friend and he's great.
Absolutely.
So Felix, let's talk a little bit about that history. Where did you actually start? What was your first role? How did you get into this? And you've done some interesting stuff on your journey up to here in your career. Let's talk a little bit about that so our audience understands your journey.
Yeah, absolutely. So in the beginning, I really like came from a place where I saw myself as a software engineer with like security, like in my hobby time and during my studies, I was doing a lot of software projects in the security space. Like I was trying out like my own exploits and rootkit technologies and just trying to learn and grasp like everything I could about technology overall. There was a great intersection with my studies where I was able to learn about malware analysis and started building systems that use virtual machine introspection to analyze malware and determine where certain important functionality lies, like for example, cryptographic functions that are important to manage botnets at the time. So all of that was really useful in my first job because we were working on a MVP for a mobile security product that would basically take existing applications on iOS and Android and transform them into more secure versions of themselves. And so that had to be all like transparent to the user. And it would enable bring your own device adoption, enterprise scale, essentially. That was the idea. And so we did a lot of the research and development for the core technology. So I was a software engineer with a security background in my first role. And I was super excited to like be in that startup environment because coming from Germany, this is all about Silicon Valley. It's about really, right? It's like you build something from the ground up and you scale it up. And that was like super exciting for me for about like 4 to 5 years. And eventually I was interested in like how are things run at larger companies here in the Valley. And so I decided Google would be the best place to figure that out. And so I decided to join Google at some point. I was in a 30-person team and we worked on the cloud identity and access management. At the time, I think it was like 1 million to 2 million queries per second. So like total opposite of what I was used to. And yeah, it couldn't have been more different and more exciting at the time. And even there, like I was able to use my security background because at the time, the cloud offerings were just emerging on the enterprise sort of functionality. And what needed to be done is a lot of work around explainability of identity and access management policies. So I was able to lead a group of people at Google that came up with the initial ideas of like how that would look like. And today that project is called, or that suite of products is called Policy Intelligence in Google Cloud. And so that was about my first 6 years of experience, or 7 years.
That's amazing. So going from building a security product for Google Cloud to now at Asana, what made you make that switch? And now you're doing a few different things. Your teams are doing a few different things. What made you take up this more, not exactly product facing, more internal facing role?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Like, I think ultimately, I was very excited to build products at Google, but I also felt like a lot of the work that I was doing wasn't leveraging my security skill set anymore. Like in the beginning, when you come up with the ideas and you validate and you build sort of like the initial MVPs, the security knowledge is like absolutely critical. But when you're in the third iteration of a product at that scale, it really is pure software development. And my security, if I kept doing this for another 10 years, I'm definitely going to be down a different career path. And I wanted to build and change the security space. And so I decided to join Block at the time and became a first-time like software engineering manager, helping anti-tampering detections for mobile payments in international markets. So that was also a product in the critical path of enabling gross payment volume. Yeah, and ultimately, after like 3 or 4 years of doing that and building out teams there, what I wanted to build out is the skill set of influencing cross-organizational. And this is what the role at Asana offered me, essentially, is to burn the problem of securing a product entirely vertically. And I knew I needed to learn a lot of new skills, which is talking more cross-functional, cross-organizational boundaries, not just manage my team, but manage expectations with product managers outside my organization, really understand what the market and the customer like expects from us. And Asana was the perfect company and perfect timing to do this because they decided at the time that their strategy is towards moving up market. And moving up market, of course, means selling to the enterprise. So that was the perfect timing for me to get into that job and help Asana succeed in that space.
That's such an amazing insight here that you have to work cross-functionally with different PM leads, different engineering managers in certain capacity. But if you're building products, you know, a lot of times your focus is in your team, your product, and obviously the customer, but more internal focus. So tell me a little bit about how is your team structured today? What are the functions, builders, breakers, everything in between? How do you define that?
Yeah, absolutely. So we do have the team split across building and breaking and the advisory functions, right? So there's distinct skill sets in like sort of the more operational aspects and the more cross-functional aspects and the software engineering aspects. And some people, they can do both. And I love to hire them and they hop between those work streams and teams seamlessly. But a lot of people, what they're really interested in is to get deeper in one specific area. Like for example, they want to be great security architecture reviewers, or they want to help implement compliance, or they want to go down a more specialized software engineering path. And in order to accommodate a wide variety of like motivations on the team, we've decided to split the team into these two arms. Like one is called product platform security. And this is essentially where the mission is ultimately to eliminate entire classes of vulnerabilities. And that happens through frameworks, guardrails, features that we build into the critical path of serving the user. And the other area of the team is called strategy and assurance. And that's where we really sort of like focus on the software development lifecycle and make sure we ship a secure product, remediate vulnerabilities, we evaluate risk appropriately, we align with the business.
That's amazing. Now, the key differences here is when you're enabling developers or dev teams to push secure code, secure cloud infrastructure, what have you, there are many ways of getting that done. One very common, very ineffective ways is to find problems, vulnerabilities, and report them and jettison again, expecting somebody to do something about it, which in a lot of cases, it doesn't work. Or if it works, it's like pulling teeth, right? So it's not great. On the other hand of the spectrum, the ideal world that gets painted a lot of times is, well, you build security guardrails and controls as the dev teams are pushing code and building their software, and that will resolve the vast majority of the issues. The reality is likely somewhere in the middle. So I'd love to just get an idea of how you think about those things, like what things are guardrails or, you know, secure defaults and what have you, those are really good for, versus what things are not good for security guardrails. Security guardrails is not a good solution for certain classes of things and you have to do something different.
Right. I think the answer like really highly depends on what the company is building, what customers they are serving, right? Like B2C and B2B products, for example, have like very different needs for security. I think specifically challenging for product security is here in Silicon Valley, we have so many like high growth companies. And so they're starting to build, like they have built a lot of codes by the time they hire the first product security engineer, you know, or even the time where you have a fully staffed product security team. And so I think that is a reality that we need to build around effectively. And so while guardrails, I have seen guardrails very effective when they're built around areas where the company already is using existing frameworks, like either has built their own frameworks or you're augmenting frameworks. And essentially where there's a well understood layer of abstraction. Whenever you're building around those layers of abstractions, you get an adoption problem, right? And so the most transparent security solutions are the ones that basically adhere to existing developer abstractions. So this really depends on like what product you're looking at and how those abstractions are built and where they exist or whether they maybe not exist because your company has a product portfolio, for example, that looks very different than if you have like one single SaaS product.
Yeah.
So I think looking at the technology abstractions is the key to understanding where security by default can be built effectively.
Yeah, I think that's actually a brilliant insight that we should all keep in mind because a lot of times people go to conferences and think about, oh, you know, so-and-so company is doing secure by default and guardrails and what have you, and we should all do the same. And they try doing it, but it doesn't work because this critical understanding of that layer of abstraction, that framework has to exist that's outside of the control of security. That's an important insight that we should very much keep in mind. Maybe you can help make it a little bit more tangible and a little bit more clear by giving an example of what that layer of abstraction looks like, what that framework actually looks like.
Yeah, absolutely. A recent example of what some of that my team is working on is rebuilding the APIs for our internal like access control framework, right? So like Asana builds a SaaS product around project management with very high complexity. There's a lot of objects that need access control. We have like projects, we have tasks, we have messages, we have teams, we have individual, like so many things. And whenever features are built, though the access control towards the objects that are being used as part of the feature development is being controlled by our access control framework. And we are right now working to make that framework a lot more like understandable and take the complexity away from the framework so that developers make less mistake that we are catching short before release and have to like scramble a fix, right? So this is really where a core abstraction that builds a critical, like a feature that is absolutely critical to most enterprises, right? It's like, you can get your access control right. And yeah, as a product security team, like we see a lot of leverage and making material improvements to the access control framework in order to eliminate certain types of vulnerabilities and then not having to worry about them in security reviews as much, for example.
That's awesome. That's pretty cool. I mean, like as you were talking, I was thinking of another example. This is way back when I was running product security teams as well. My company was just starting to adopt React. And I believe React had a significant number of secure by default things that you could use as compared to Angular before that or what have you. And all it took was making sure that the developers are not using those dangerously set HTML type, you know, type things within React. So that could become a good guardrail function for us that we actually implemented in the pipe. But that was dependent on adoption of React. Like if they were using a different framework without those things, and we couldn't really do much about it.
Yeah, I think you bring up an excellent point here, right? Like much of the guardrails don't have to be developed in-house, right? Sometimes these guardrails already exist externally and maybe just recommending them like the React framework to be used already eliminates a lot of risk or makes the risk more tangible.
Yeah, and similar examples I'm sure exist around containers as well. You know, you could do the whack-a-mole approach of scanning for containers and filing vulnerabilities, but a better guardrail approach would be to just have everyone use approved base images on containers that somebody else maintains and make sure there's enough patching. There's multiple layers of complexity on this, but that could be a good approach for enforcing those guardrails in these cases. So what I find really interesting about your background, Felix, is that you've been in the business of building software, running engineering teams, software building teams, but especially at some of the companies that you worked at, I'm sure there's very, very strong engineering practices for effective software building. Now, as you're running these security teams, builders and breakers and assurance teams, are there any things that you learned during your time as an engineering leader that you're now applying in a security team and managing security teams?
Oh, absolutely. I think there's a variety of things. Maybe the most prominent that comes to my mind right now is building for the customer and really like having a conscious thought about who is your customer and how you're serving the customer best. Product engineers, they kind of do that naturally because they have a product manager whose job it is to, you know, think about much else than like, what does the customer need? For security team or security engineers, they come out from a place where they're thinking about risks, right? They're thinking about what goes wrong. And obviously that's very critical to focus on the risks and work on mitigation. The question though is how, right? And when you get to the how question, then you get to the question of who are you serving? Who's your customer? So I love to just ask that question when I start managing a new team. It's like, do you understand who's your customer? And then we have all these conversations. Well, maybe the customer is like the paying customer. Maybe the customer is the developer. Maybe the customer is the product manager. And then we try to structure the answer. And I think the answer is essentially like, I guess product security, we are serving the product engineering division or organization, right? With all its members. Those include managers, software engineers, designers, product managers, all that makes the organization that builds the product. And so when you get to that level of clarity, a lot of the solution building, you can use that philosophy in a lot of the solutions that you're building. Let me give you an example. Like when we build a security review process, we build it in a way where there is a go link that any engineer can just go to. When they go to the go link, they will find a set of questions. They'll answer those questions. They're related to like what they're building, right? Is it like IO only? Is it, are they touching an API? Are they changing the way data is stored, et cetera, et cetera. And after that, there's no other process for the time being. So almost like a fire and forget kind of 5-minute thing and you're done. And what we do in the back end as a product security team is like we triage those submissions and we look at them. And based on the vector that we're getting from software engineers, we know roughly what is like the worst case that we could be looking at here and the way in which we triage and decide what to review specifically and how deep. And from a product engineer standpoint, this is a really easy process. They don't have to manage another process because imagine like if you're on a product team, like there's already so much going on. There's like bugs, there's feature requests, there's deadlines. And now if your security team comes along and says, oh, you need to talk to us as well every time you build a feature and you don't structure that engagement and you don't make it easy for them, you're just filling their plate even more. And so I think if you, from a product security standpoint, you're really thinking about, oh, you're serving a customer and you want to serve them like fast, efficient, and you want to build that empathy for what are all the other things that they have on their plate. And then you build that into your processes and your technology, maintaining a good relationship and even facilitating product engineers to come to you unexpectedly with concerns that they have is something that has extreme leverage.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point that you got to have empathy for your customers and think about the various personas in your customers. On the other hand, just the other way of looking at it is also that as a security leader, in a lot of cases, it's our job to help manage the risk at the end of the day. And the customer might not understand that it's their responsibility as well. And they might not agree, they might not understand, they might not realize it. So in those cases, it takes a different lens. So like some things are like you can't do, you're just not allowed to, versus other things are more flexible and you can work with them on it. How do you decide those boundaries? What is that you can't cross that line versus, yes, we'll work with you on it and you're our customer, we'll do the right thing for you?
Right. So we try to weave this into our processes. Let me give you an example. We have certain like SLAs for P0 vulnerabilities. So P0 vulnerability, we expect the team to look at that the same day and like start prioritizing a fix for the bug. So this is like basically all hands on deck situation. Now, if we go all the way to the beginning of a feature where a P0 bug isn't introduced yet, and you have the situation where the team is planning, like you said in the example, something that shouldn't be done, probably if it goes to production, it ends up being a P0 bug. And so I can tell that story right at the beginning. I don't have to be the person saying no if I establish a good boundary of responsibility of security, because in the beginning, I already set that boundary as like, ultimately, you as product engineering, you own security, like you own reliability, like you own accessibility, like you own your all the other non-functional things on top of like making your customers happy. And well, I guess reliability, security are making customers happy. At least they're not there. Customers are unhappy, right? It's as much their responsibility as all the other aspects. And I see product security as like helping them become better in the decision making and become more effective and efficient in managing their security and also understanding what risks to take. So now back to your example, like if we have a new feature, for example, that where someone is proposed that, you know, would lead to a P0 bug, we will let the team know in their security review and we will say, hey, this is really something you need to fix before you go to production. You know, these are the reasons, this is the risk, why the risk is unacceptable, and this is why it will be a P0 bug. And because all those agreements are already established, like they know the day they would launch this, they have to get all hands on deck and fix it. So now, like, they don't want to get into that situation. So now they rather seek out the help and say, okay, then help us understand how to fix this in order to avoid even running into that situation down the road. So yeah. I think that's like very important tool is to sort of start with like, oh, this is going to be a vulnerability and this is what the severity is going to be. And as a result of that, we're going to ask you to fix it anyway. You can make a decision of whether you want to do it now or later. Yeah. In all cases that I have seen, these issues get resolved very quickly.
Yeah. So my takeaway from this conversation is that, yes, you have to build empathy and you have to serve your customers, but you also need a good framework to operate within. You have to have those lane markers that if there is a piece in production, it is an all hands on deck kind of a situation and you have to address it. Like short of that, it is too much decision making, I guess, or too little risk management. But given the framework of how to address certain things when it really, really goes into production and we identify these things, there has to be like less debates about how do you respond to that, but more about how do you prevent it and how do you avoid getting into that situation. That's awesome. This is fantastic insights here. You've been in security and software development for a while. Tell me a little bit about what have you seen over the past few years that's changing, that's interesting for you?
Well, so more recently, of course, the change to see generative AI actually create things that look more and more credible. And I think that's a change that, although it's like fairly new, it's in like maybe a year or a year and a half, I think that's already been radically changed how we think about our potential future, both in like software development, but also in product security. So I think AI is something that I would love to get back to at the end and talk a little bit more about how AI could be transforming software development and product security as a result. If I look a little bit further back, I would say I'm seeing more and more of a push for sort of standardization in the industry. And I see this like happening through like multiple verticals. Like for example, if you look at supply chain security, it's great to see the focus, but I think there's still a lot of work to be done. For example, today when we sell to enterprise customers, a lot of the evaluation for us as a vendor goes through like custom questionnaires where we have to put a lot of grease behind a process that like serves customer staff in the sales cycle and really gets accurate answers to the questions. And then also does accurate change management as we improve our security posture over time, of course. I feel like there's a lot of opportunity here for standardization and automation. Like why can I not just automatically query the important security controls in all the vendors that we are like sub-processors and dependencies that we have? Why can I not create security policies? And so I have learned that there's a lot more missing in this space than I thought there was. And I'm pretty excited to hopefully see the industry make some progress there through standardization, right? I think we have some technology like SBOMs, but they're not tying yet into the process of the sales cycle and recurring like cycles of evaluation. So I think if those gaps are going to be closed, I think we're going to be in a vastly like better world in terms of security assurance of the supply chain.
You know, that's an interesting point that you would want to understand the security controls implemented in the software lifecycle of the vendors you're working with. Is there any specific framework? I mean, you mentioned SBOMs, but is there any Securus DLC framework that you're seeing as an emerging option here?
Not to my knowledge. I see different vendors in the space. For example, we have a trust center at Asana where customers can go and like see what is our security posture, what our processes, what our certifications. But to the degree that I know, there exists nothing that allows for like automation of that check. I still have to click my way through. Even if I have an SBOM, now I basically just have pointers of like where else to look. Ingesting and processing that information in an automated way, like that's really where I would love to get to. And that's where I see the gap. And I don't see anybody in the industry yet offering something end-to-end. And I think the reason is because it's an industry adoption problem, right? Mm-hmm. Like, how long did it take us to adopt TLS? Like, was it like 10 years? Was it 15 years? I don't even know, like, how many revisions like have happened. And now we're in a pretty good place, I would say. And not using TLS is like basically equivalent to not being trustworthy on the internet at all. And I hope that with the supply chain situation, like, we'll get there eventually, but it's going to be certainly a longer term thing.
Yeah. I mean, the unfortunate reality of our situation, of our space, is that it's either a major breach that drives certain things, or it's the regulation that has to come in and drives adoption of certain standards. Unfortunately, historically speaking, outside of those things, there haven't been major pushes for significantly adoption or significant framework. I've been hearing some interesting things around in NIST controls around SDLC and Salsa framework. Again, very, very early stages for all of those things. It's nowhere close to mass adoption. But the other day, there was another guest on this podcast, and they were talking about cybersecurity insurance being the driver behind this. Now, cybersecurity insurance has a certain role to play in it, but it sounds like some people are championing that insurance will be much cheaper if you provide that access to that controls information or the security posture information across your software development lifecycle or your software supply chain. And even if we go in that direction, we're still 5 to 10 years away from a mass adoption. But at least there's some hope for some regulatory body pushing standardization of these frameworks. So in terms of what we are excited about in the future, I'm definitely not excited about cyber insurance. I am more interested in hearing your thoughts on what you're excited about in the future. You mentioned generative AI. What about generative AI? What gets you excited?
Yeah, I mean, it gets me both excited and a little bit anxious. Excited because I think it is an opportunity to make software development a lot more effective. But with it, there's going to be a lot of change. And I'm curious how that's going to play out, especially in the product security space. Like, for example, think about a case where developers are able to crank out like 10x to 100x of the amount of code. Are they going to produce 10x to 100x the amount of vulnerabilities? Like, if the code quality stays the same, and we just then allow ourselves to generate more code, like, that's probably going to be the outcome. So the only way to prevent that is to make sure that AI generated code is radically more secure than humanly generated code. I think it's a bit of a problem in practice because there's only human written code as training data, right? And that's sort of like where AI usually becomes the average of the training data. I'm curious how that's going to work out for product security, right? And there's one reason why, while I'm excited for developers to build more code, I'm anxious to also have to deal with a lot more vulnerabilities. And then the question is, how do we scale on the product? Like, if that were to happen, right? If that's the world that we move towards, how are we going to scale product security? And now the easy answer is like, well, okay, let's use AI. But the problem with AI right now, at least, is it reliable enough to do security assurance? Yeah, it's reliable enough to like generate a picture, or it's reliable enough to generate marketing material. Like, is it reliable enough to generate a design for an airplane? Probably not, right? Or like medical devices. Where do you set the boundary, and like, where do you measure that? And so when it comes to product security and you're starting to use AI in your processes, now you get into like a second layer of assurance of your product security to make sure you do proper product security assurance. So I think that's going to be a really interesting dynamic to play out. The other thing I could see in the future is that software just becomes more and more ephemeral. Like, if we are able to build, let's say we are in a world where AI was able to generate entire products from like an idea spec, right? You say, oh, I want to build a messenger, and it's like peer-to-peer, I want it all encrypted and secure and this and that. And now AI spits out the solution. Then we're not going to do A/B testing around like features anymore. We're going to A/B test like different products. Someone will be sitting there generating products. Of course, it's very far off. But in that case, the question is, what is security now? Like, where's security built? If you have ephemeral software, now there isn't enough justification to build processes to secure that software, because once you get to that point, you probably generated the next version of it, and they may look entirely different. Right? So I'm curious how software development itself will change as part of AI-generated software. And I anticipate this is going to have vast impacts on how product security is going to look like in the future.
That's a very foundational question, right? Because if you're trusting at some point in the future, if you're trusting AI to generate a lot of these things, but at the same time, we also know that Gen AI, LLMs do not create net new knowledge, but they leverage training data to synthesize vast amount of information in different ways. So with that assumption, they probably are not coming up with net new designs or net new architectures of things. So then that problem still needs to be solved by humans, but at a different scale, at a different velocity than what we are used to. So then we were guessing that we would need some sort of generative AI copilot who helps us understand this massively vast and fast-moving information in a faster way so that enables the security people to play a higher order role in generating or reviewing or making this net new information more secure, whereas the AI is taking care of the repetitive things and based on patterns, based on training data, it continues to operate the known path, but humans look at net new paths, right? Potentially.
Yeah, and we're already seeing like some areas where this is being prototyped, right? For example, let's say a technical design document. Can AI point out potentially risky areas of that design? Probably to some degree. Should a human look over the results before taking that in to make the decisions of what to look at? Yeah, absolutely, right? And the question is, how do we evolve that process, right? How do we get to the point where we maybe trust more and more into AI, but we are also have the confidence that we will identify potential regressions?
Yeah.
That's really like where, you know, more and more things become a black box, the harder it is to identify when the process doesn't deliver the results that you want. And so how are we going to deal with that?
As you were saying this, I have an idea. Maybe this will be a possibility real time soon. Let's say one of your security architects is reviewing a new design. So typically, they would want to read the design document, read the PRD, read the Jira tickets, read Confluence pages, what have you, or Asana pages. What if, without getting any context, the first time the security architect meets dev team or the program manager or the product manager, the copilot has already read through all of this information, read through all the Jira tickets, all the discussions in Slack, all of these documentation that has been created about this feature and creates a synthetic summary of those things. So now your architect can make decisions very quickly based on all this. Now you're not spending hours and hours reading through the documentation. You're making decisions on important stuff right away. That could be very powerful.
Sounds like a fantastic idea. Let me know when you start building that at Tromso.
Fantastic. I'm putting that on the roadmap right away after this. Felix, this has been a phenomenal conversation. Thank you so much for spending your time with me here. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much as well. Really enjoyed our conversation.
Thanks for listening to The Future of Application Security. If you've enjoyed this episode or you are new to the show, I'd love to have you subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss any episode. And if you like the podcast, I'd be grateful if you can leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Thank you for listening.